From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It was just about 2 weeks ago when the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in the case of Trump versus United States. It's a case that looks at the issue of presidential immunity from criminal prosecution. And during those arguments, we finally got a hint of what the justices were thinking in a case that has far-reaching implications for not just the former president, but for all former and future presidents. Dr. David Adler, president of the Alturas Institute, is going to break down the case and how it relates to the U.S. Constitution this Thursday at his next Constitutional Conversation, which will be at Boise State University's Yonke Center. And he's back to give us a preview. Hi, Dr. Adler.
Nice to see you or to be with you again, Gemma. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Adler, as I mentioned, you're talking about the Supreme Court case over immunity for former President Trump on Thursday. Can you quickly break down that case for us?
Right. This is a landmark case, as you indicated, Gemma, has implications for the rule of law, American democracy, and certainly applications and implications for future presidents as well. What's at issue here is Donald Trump's claim of absolute immunity from criminal prosecution, a claim that he believes all presidents need, otherwise they'll be subject to potential criminal prosecution after they leave office. And also, in Trump's own words, a president can't do his job unless he's immune from criminal prosecution. The government, of course, is bringing prosecution and denying his central claim of immunity, stating that there is no such thing in the text of the Constitution or the architecture of the Constitution, and that, in fact, it would endanger the rule of law if presidents were granted absolute immunity from criminal prosecution. And so this case brings to the forefront one of the most important issues that could ever be raised in a republic governed by the rule of law, because the framers of the Constitution were committed to the idea of subordinating every citizen, including the president, to the rule of law.
So can you give us both sides of these oral arguments that happened last month and what, in your opinion, the justices focused in on during those oral arguments?
Sure. It was really riveting, Gemma. I think people who tuned in were introduced to a seminar on how the Supreme Court approaches a critical issue such as the allegation or the assertion of immunity from criminal prosecution for the presidency. To begin with, the oral argument was fascinating because half the court roughly indicated that it was not interested in the facts of this case, much more interested, I think, in looking at potential future cases and how the court might write a rule to govern the issue of immunity. As Justice Gorsuch said, we're going to write a rule for the ages. And certainly that's true. What the court will say in this case will have widespread implications for the future of the presidency and the rule of law. The three foremost justices who were less interested in the facts of the case, more interested, as I say, in writing a rule for the future, that would be Alito and Kavanaugh and certainly Gorsuch, to some extent Roberts, indicated that perhaps through their questioning that they were contemplating that while the president might not enjoy absolute immunity, there might be circumstances in which the president would indeed be entitled to immunity from criminal prosecution for carrying out his core functions. That's the big question mark. On the other side, the women on the court, as it turns out, the female justices were probing the facts of the current case that led to the prosecution of Donald Trump and were interested in applying a rule to govern this case, but also to the future as well. And so the oral argument tells us that the court very much is going to write what it conceives as a very important opinion on this case, one that no doubt the justices believe will rise to the occasion and meet the great issues of this case. What's uncertain, of course, is just when the court might write its opinion, Gemma. Many had hoped that the court would resolve this case quickly. Some had hoped that the court might have heard the argument way back last December when the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, asked the court to grant certiorari, knowing that at some point the court would be asked to rule on these important separation of powers questions, principally the issue of immunity from criminal prosecution. And the court did not indicate any interest in doing that. And that meant that people hoped that after the circuit court rendered its ruling, that maybe the court would either agree not to hear the case because of the belief that there's no credible ground for a president to assert absolute immunity from the law, or else that the court would hear the oral argument and then, as in past landmark cases, such as the Pentagon Papers case in 1971 or the Steele seizure case in 1952, or even the Watergate tapes case in 1974, would render a decision within days, allowing the system to move forward. And now it appears that the court is not going to move quickly, perhaps for a number of reasons, but is likely to remand this case back to the federal district judge, Judge Chutkan. And what we don't know is if the court will remand it and say, green light, hold the trial immediately, or perhaps ask the court, instruct the court to make findings of fact on certain issues to decide whether this case presents one of those in which there is no absolute immunity, but what are those circumstances in which a president might enjoy immunity? All of which then, Gemma, suggests that we're not going to have a trial before the election. And indeed, if President Trump should win re-election, probably no trial ever, because he would order these charges, this case, to be dismissed. And so I said at the outset that this is a fascinating, indeed riveting oral argument, because Americans were introduced to how the court works and dealing with the specific issues in this case. But the reality is the case comes down to a pretty clear difference of opinion. The government is arguing that there is no criminal prosecution for Donald Trump, certainly not absolute. And even if the court wants to find that there are some exceptions, that is, that there might be circumstances where a president does enjoy immunity from prosecution, this is not such a case. On the other side, defending former President Trump, the argument is that, in fact, the president needs absolute immunity in order to perform the functions of the office. And that, indeed, as most Americans glean from all the news coverage that they have observed, that indeed the president believes that he might in fact have authority to order the assassination of his political opponents. As sweeping a claim as that is, that's what Trump and Trump's attorney are arguing, and that was once more asserted before the Supreme Court in oral argument, Gemma.
So, Dr. Adler, we've been hearing the term the doctrine of originalism in regards to this case. Can you explain to us what that means and how it applies to the Constitution?
Sure. The importance of originalism arises because this court, or a majority of the court, has professed its preference for originalism as the means to approach the Constitution, and thus it's given great weight. And what the doctrine of originalism stands for is that the court is looking for the original meaning of a given constitutional provision, and that meaning should govern. Well, that raises the question of the method or the methodology by which that original intention, that is, the original intention of those who wrote the Constitution, should be discovered. And according to originalists, that means you go through a process. You look at the text of the Constitution to see if a particular provision has pretty clear meaning in the case before the court. If the text of the Constitution can satisfy the question or questions before the court, then the matter really could be brought to an end. But of course, there would be very few cases ever brought before court that could be disposed of summarily on the basis of the text. We might have a hypothetical in which somebody asserts that they have a right to run for the presidency. They're only 30 years old. If some far-fetched case reached the Supreme Court, the court could say, no, we see here in Article 2 that somebody has to be 35 years old to be president. But that approach then would be disposed of on textual grounds. If the issue before the court cannot be disposed of by textual reference, Gemma, then the originalists say we're going to go back to the records of the Constitutional Convention to see what the framers of the Constitution said during the course of discussion and debate on the applicable provision or clause before the court. And this means that the court now is engaged in a historical inquiry, searching the records that were primarily the records kept by James Madison during the long summer of 1787, from May to September 17. And they are found in four bound volumes. It's been printed, reprinted millions of times. This historical inquiry, the originalist hope then, would shed significant light on the particular question. Now, as you would imagine, there are issues, deep issues associated with this historical inquiry. Among them, the justices are not trained historians, they're not historical scholars, so they've not been informed or introduced to the way in which historians would examine these documents or records. That might be one issue. A second would be, are the records themselves clear? Do they tell us the full story? What happens if the records are incomplete on the particular provision that might that is at the center of the issue before the court? So there are those historical matters at play. If the records in the Constitutional Convention don't dispose of an issue, then an originalist would look at the records of the state ratifying conventions, those that held discussions and debates on the crucial question of whether the people of the United States should adopt the proposed Constitution. From there, Gemma, originalists would look at other documents that were contemporaneous with the framing of the Constitution, including the Federalist Papers or the Anti-Federalist Papers and a few others. And then the court would look at early precedents. So this approach, combined with an overall look at the Constitution as an edifice, which could provide us certain insights about what the document as a whole means, are part and parcel of originalism. And the originalist justice would say, once we have found out what the text and the Constitution and the tradition tell us about the meaning of the Constitution, then that answers the question that provides us with the holding. And so, if we apply that approach, the approach that is embraced by several of the justices on the current court, to this particular case, the idea is that it would yield a conclusive answer on whether the president enjoys immunity. And in this regard, Gemma, one of the most interesting questions raised during oral argument, and it happened to be the first question, was raised by Justice Clarence Thomas, who is an avowed originalist, and he asked Trump's attorney, where in Article 2 of the Constitution do you anchor the assertion of presidential immunity from criminal prosecution? That's the key question. It was the right question from an originalist perspective. And if so, that was meant to draw out any statements about a textual statement, for example, of the existence of executive immunity for the president, or whether there was something said during the discussions and debates in the Constitutional Convention that would provide an anchor provide evidence to support President Trump's assertion of executive immunity.
So how would this approach in this particular case impact former President Trump's claim of immunity from criminal prosecution?
Well, I think that's the key question to ask, Gemma. The reality here is that when Clarence Thomas, Justice Thomas, asked where in Article 2 do you find the support for the assertion of executive immunity for the president, you would expect that there would be some language that would be asserted. But in fact, Article 2 doesn't provide any language addressing executive immunity. You would then expect an argument that it could be found in some part of the debates during the long summer of 1787. And yet the historical record tells us the framers never contemplated the idea of granting to the president any immunity from criminal prosecution. That convention granted limited immunity to Congress, but decided not to even consider the question of immunity for the president. And indeed, during those proceedings, several framers made arguments to the effect that the president would not be treated any differently than any other citizen. James Wilson said that the president would not enjoy privileges not annexed to the character of citizenship enjoyed by all others. James Iredell of North Carolina said, quote, the president is triable, and so forth. So from the approach of originalism, if the court truly were to decide this case based on its professed adherence to originalism, the court could not conclude that there is any evidence to support the claim of absolute presidential immunity from criminal prosecution. What the court might do is that it might determine that there are some circumstances that would create limited immunity for the president from criminal prosecution. And this is what at least two or three or four of the questions at oral argument were probing. And the expectation is that some of the justices, if they choose to address this possibility in this particular case, as opposed to awaiting a case in which other circumstances arise which raise the question of immunity for the president in the performance of quote-unquote core functions, the court might in fact determine that there are limited circumstances which create an immunity for the president. And some have speculated, for example, that it could involve those acts of political discretion for the president. For example, the president could not be prosecuted for vetoing legislation or signing a bill into law, because those are those represent the essence of the president's political discretion, or granting a pardon and so forth. So if the case is decided, I think, on originalist terms, Gemma, then there could not be support for absolute immunity. What we don't know is whether the court might also want to probe this other question of limited immunity in some limited circumstances.
Okay, so then in your opinion, would this type of immunity then place the president above the rule of law, whether it's complete immunity or limited immunity?
Well, certainly in the case of the declaration by the court of absolute immunity, it would be placing the president above the law. And future presidents could proceed with impunity. They might, as Donald Trump has said, order the assassination of political opponents and so forth, other egregious acts. And because there is no basis in the our constitutional architecture legal system to support the assertion of immunity, this would be placing the president above the law. He could essentially concentrate all power of the government in his hands. He could place himself in a situation where he was unassailable He might decide to stay in office more than 4 years. He might dismiss cases that are targeting his political favorites, or he might order the Justice Department to go after political enemies and prosecute them. This would essentially give rise to an authoritarian presidency.
So, given what we heard from the Supreme Court justices during these oral arguments, do you have a sense of which way they may be leaning in this case? And I know that's kind of a crapshoot to ask that question.
Well, it's a good question. We all wonder. And while I'm hesitant to offer predictions of what the court will do on oral argument, simply because the questions don't always reflect what the justices are in their minds determined to do, or the path that they're following in their reasoning at that point in time. I would find it hard to believe that this court would say that the president would have absolute immunity. What seems more likely to me is we might have two or three justices writing concurring opinions, if indeed the ultimate court opinion is a denial of immunity, nonetheless weighing in on the side that the president enjoys some limited immunity, but perhaps not in this case, which would mean then the case goes back to the federal district judge. Trial can proceed, but one hopes that it's not sent to the judge with orders to hold evidentiary hearings on those hypothetical questions, because that would delay this case for a very long time. So the goal, of course, would be that the court would simply order the trial to go forward, a full bright green light. What that would yield for us as citizens of this republic, Gemma, is that if the trial wasn't completed, and it's unlikely to be completed, at least the initial hearings would allow us to allow the public to understand more fully what's being charged against Trump and what the responses are, and to take those hearings into account before we go to the polls in November. It seems to me that the American people are entitled to know whether this former president violated the law so that they can make a solemn decision on the crucial question. Do they want a president in office who has violated the law, perhaps committed serious felonies or not?
I only have about 2 minutes left with you, Dr. Adler. So very quickly, can you tell us what implications, if any, there would be for former and future presidents when it comes to this case?
Yes, I think what is very concerning is that if there is a grant of absolute immunity for the president, then the president can order actions to be taken against all of his political opponents. He can build a moat around the White House in which he sits. He would be unassailable. It would place the president above the law. And one's imagination can soar to contemplate the ways in which presidents would abuse power to promote their own interest. What's particularly frightening, but the public has to rise to the moment and face the universe, is that if a president enjoys absolute immunity from criminal prosecution in the United States, then that is parallel to what authoritarian leaders enjoy in other countries, including Orban in Hungary, for example, and Erdogan in Turkey, and certainly Putin in Russia. And that's why this question, Gemma, is of such critical importance to the future of the republic. If a president is indeed above the law, then there's no way to limit the president. And this certainly would run dramatically counter to the kind of presidency that the framers of the Constitution created 200 years ago, when they rightly celebrated their achievement. That is, that they had succeeded in subordinating the presidency to the rule of law, something other countries had attempted to do historically, but had been unsuccessful. That was something to behold. It was a great achievement. The question for us now is whether that celebration becomes merely a thing of the ancient past, or whether Americans are going to cling to the idea of the rule of law and continue to embrace the idea that all people, including the president, are subjected to the same law, no exceptions for people who hold office, high or low, or people who are in office or outside office. That's the great question before us now. The Supreme Court is about to play the most central role in the determination of the future of the presidency and the rule of law in a way that surpasses all the other cases, the important cases that it has ruled on regarding presidential power. This is a stunning moment. It's a great teaching moment for us, Gemma, and Americans should pay very close attention to this case because the democracy that we have known, the commitment to the rule of law that we have known, are up for grabs at this key moment.
Well, Dr. Adler, as always, appreciate your time today. We've been talking with Dr. David Adler, the president of the Alturas Institute. His constitutional conversations will be this Thursday. It will focus on the Supreme Court, Donald Trump, originalism, and presidential power. It will be at BSU's Yonkey Center in Boise. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.